Okay, welcome. Now we can really get going on this retreat. I always say the first few hours of the retreat until the first breakfast, we're just settling in. It does take a while for everybody to settle in on a meditation retreat, even though there's much more settling in to be done. You'll find that at least now you've had a good rest, had a good breakfast, and maybe now the mind can really start getting peaceful and still. Sometimes it's like when you are in your house and you go outside into the dark. Sometimes at first you can't see anything because it takes a while for the eyes to adjust, for the iris to expand, for the pupil to get bigger, so that more light can come into the retina. So when you go outside, at first you can't see anything. And little by little, you start to see shapes. And as you stay outside longer and longer, then things start to become clear to you. It's a very good simile of what happens in meditation. At first, when you start meditating, it's your mind is not adjusted yet to the stillness, to the silence. Or at first, all you can see is darkness. But as you proceed on this meditation retreat, when your mind becomes accustomed to the silence, to the lack of activity, to the peace, then the mind will start to expand just like the iris of your eye. And as it expands more and more, you begin to see more and more. The Dhamma starts to take shape. At first it's only silhouettes, but after a while you start to see more detail. You see more detail as the mind accustoms itself to the silence. So this is what we're doing on this retreat, accustoming ourselves to the silence, allowing the mind to become still. I wrote a book some years ago, a small booklet called The Basic Method of Meditation, and I'm going to go through some of the parts of that book this morning. This is just the basic road into deep meditation. I say it's a basic, not because it is just for elementary students. It's basic because it's the foundation of letting go. The foundation of allowing the mind to go into deep states of samadhi and stillness so you can really see things as they truly are. It's basic in the sense of it's fundamental, not because it's elementary. And that basic method, that fundamental method, can be applied to whatever meditation object you are doing. I usually mention the breath meditation because that's common. That was the meditation the Buddha used under the Bodhi tree. But it doesn't matter whether you use loving kindness meditation, meditation on the body or whatever. The same principles apply. What we're doing is we're letting go of many of our attachments, little by little. We're not throwing them away forever in meditation. Abandoning them forever is the path of insight. But we need to do that stillness first of all, to put them down temporarily so we can see what it's like. And then maybe we'll be able to put them down permanently. I'm going to give you a very simple simile about meditation. And I hope that you can see the purpose behind this simile, its meaning. I'm going to hold up my cup now. This cup symbolizes my mind. I'm going to try and keep this cup still. Like many people when they're meditating, they try and hold their mind still. I've been practicing this for many years, trying to hold a cup still. Even though I've had much practice at this, I cannot keep this cup absolutely still. It is still shaking slightly. Maybe you are a long way away, but where I'm sitting, I can see it moving. I might try even harder to keep this cup still. Whatever I do, I cannot keep this cup absolutely still. And I realize why. Because I am holding it. I am grasping it. If I want this cup to be still, what should I do? Yes, you got the message. And now it's still. Now it's not moving. And also, it's effortless. It's easy. Now, can you understand about our mind? Why is it that sometimes we can't get success in meditation? We can't get stillness? It is because you are holding your mind. When you hold things, it shakes. When you let it down, it becomes still. Now that's a theme which goes throughout the stages of meditation. Even though I put this down, when I still put it down, it still shakes a little bit. The water inside it is still moving. But because I am not holding anymore, the movement in the water is getting less and less and less. And in a few seconds, it gets absolutely still. That's like your mind. The trick of meditation is leaving the mind alone, letting it go, detaching, disengaging, leaving it alone, not doing anything, letting go of craving, letting go of thinking, not managing it, abandoning it. As the Buddha said in his second sermon, the first teachings of the Buddha were incredibly profound. The first teaching, I mentioned some of it earlier, the next part of that teaching, as you know, will be the Eightfold Path. That made the first Sri Muni. The second teaching on non-self made the first five Arahats. Now this has powerful teachings. What the Buddha said in that second sermon is very, very deep and incredibly effective, if you can do it. He said that these five khandhas, the body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness, if you read it carefully, you'll see the Buddha said that these things aren't mine. They don't belong to us. If they were yours, you will be able to say, oh, may my body be like this, may my body be like that. Because you can't say that. You can't do that. It proves this body does not belong to you. You know, I can't stop my nose itching. You can't stop your back aching. It would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if you were in control of this body and say, okay, I'm on retreat now, for the next 9 days, don't hurt. The body is not yours. And you know that, you can't control your body. So in meditation, we leave our body alone. We put it down and say, right body, I've looked after you, I've set you down in your meditation posture, now, if you don't mind me being crude, shove off, body. It's like many of you who've come in a car, in a vehicle when you came here today. Those of you who've come in your own car, you parked your car outside, you've locked it, you put on the alarm system, now you can forget about it for 9 days. Now that's what you do with your body. You park it on your meditation cushion, you lock it with mindfulness, the alarm system's on, you can forget about it. For 9 days you don't have to worry about your body. It's called letting go, putting it down. That's the only way you can get peace. It doesn't belong to me, not my problem, therefore you don't think about it. The same with Vedana. Feelings of pleasure and pain in the body or in any other senses doesn't belong to me. If you start to seek pleasure, if you want the bliss of meditation, you will never get it. So let it go. It doesn't belong to me, it's just feeling, that's all. If it was yours, you'd be able to always tell it to do what you want it to. Even perceptions, even mental formations, even consciousness, even your meditation does not belong to you. If it did, you'd be able to get into jhana straight away anytime you want. Now, do you understand some of our mistakes? You're letting go. This body, this mind doesn't belong to me. So, just like your body, put it down on the cushion and abandon it. Your mind, put it down on your meditation cushion and abandon it. Leave it alone. This cup doesn't belong to me. I put it down. Then it becomes still. The deepest path of meditation is the path of just abandoning, letting go, leaving things alone. If you want the fast way to deep meditation and enlightenment, don't do anything. Just sit there, don't do anything at all. That inside which is the will, which is the chooser, the commentator, abandon it completely. And then, little by little, you go into deep stages of stillness, you go into the present moment, into a very silent mind. The breath will come up, the breath will soon become extremely beautiful, a beautiful light will appear in the mind and limiter, you go into the jhanas, you just rush through the jhanas into cessation itself. That's if you can really let go. Now, for the rest of us, we have to almost be led, kicking and screaming, into letting go. We have to be guided, almost tricked sometimes, into abandoning our controller, abandoning our mind, putting it down. And so because most of us haven't got the wisdom, haven't got the selflessness, haven't got the ability to do meditation that easily, we have to hold your hand and take you stage by stage by stage on the path of abandoning. Because of that, we talk about a basic method of meditation. So you know what happens when you let go. You know how the mind becomes peaceful. You realize what you have to do, or rather what you don't have to do, in order to proceed into a next stage of meditation. A beautiful simile, again, to give the overall theme of meditation, is something I mentioned last night about going in. All the stages of meditation are like an old simile I gave of the petals of a flower. The next layer of petals is right within the one you're experiencing now. You see these flowers over here where they close up? The next layer of petals is inside. You don't need to go anywhere else in this meditation. You don't need to throw whatever you're experiencing away because you think it's not good enough. All you need to do is to go deeper in to what you're experiencing now. For example, if you're in pain, you don't need to throw that pain away, just to go into the very center of it, and there you'll find no pain at all. If your mind is sleepy, don't try and get rid of the sleepiness, go right into the center of it, in the middle of it. You'll find this awakeness there. If your mind is restless, and you're thinking about all sorts of things, go right into the center of that restlessness. You'll find there is peace. You can never go wrong in a meditation if you go into the center of things, because that's where the next layer, the next level lies. You never go on to the next stage in meditation. You go in to the next stage of meditation. Never on, but in. It's like a big temple, and the temple is not built like a temple here. It's a temple with concentric rings. So you go in the door, and this big circular gallery, and you go into there, and there's another circular gallery within that one, and there's another circular gallery within that one, and within that there's another circular gallery, as you go in towards the center of the room. And of course, in the very middle of that room is where the Buddha sits. Or like those Russian dolls, which you may have seen. There's a wooden doll. You open it up and there's a smaller doll inside. You take that out and there's another little doll inside. That's a simile for what meditation is. The next stage of the meditation is right within the one you're experiencing now. I'll give you a story. One of those stories from my life which told me very clearly what I'd been doing wrong and how I should really meditate. I'd been 6 years as a monk. It was my sixth rains retreat, my sixth wassa. And I was meditating in a monastery in the north of Thailand. It was absolutely perfect. I couldn't have wished for a better monastery. It was in the mountains, in a valley. The food was adequate and to my taste. Not only that, the lay people there, it was only a small village which supported me. It was over a hill. So I had to walk up this hill, down the other side in the adjacent valley. That's where the village was. So where the monastery was, I couldn't see or hear anybody. It was high up in the mountains. So only if I was looking would I see the weekly car. Talk about traffic, there's one car a week. And if you weren't looking, you would miss it. And the villagers, they'd love to give you alms, but they weren't interested in listening to Dhamma. Which to me, that was great. So they left me alone all day. For 23 and a half hours of every day, I was completely free. The half an hour was when I went to the village on alms round to get the food, to say hello, give a blessing, and then go back again. And I was by myself in this monastery. No other monks. No attendants. Didn't need one. Could look after myself. And I was in solitude. It was perfect. So the first month I had a wonderful time meditating. Well, maybe the first couple of weeks. But then I started to get restless. And as my mind got more and more restless, it started getting out of control. And after 1 month, it was getting very out of control. I was thinking some very unmonkish thoughts. Romance, sex, science fiction, anything. My mind would go all over the place. And the more I tried to stop it, the harder it got to stop. And unfortunately, I didn't, or maybe fortunately as it turned out, I didn't have another monk to talk to. There was no teacher there. And not even a friend. I was by myself. And one day it got so bad. I thought, my goodness, if this carries on, I'm going to disrobe. It's terrible. So I went up to the Buddha statue in the main hall. And I bowed 3 times. And I said, like, help. Please, you know, give me some inspiration so I can know how I can deal with this restless mind, which was getting more and more out of control. And an idea came to me. The idea was this. It's probably because, not from the Buddha, or maybe, you never know, but it was because I was a Westerner, I decided I'd do a deal. I'd do a deal with my mind. I said, mind, for 23 hours of the day, and I take off the sleep as well, maybe 19 hours of the day, please let me watch the breath and be peaceful. But for 1 hour of the day, part of the deal, for 1 hour of the day, and I chose 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., you can think whatever you like. Anything goes between 3 and 4 o'clock. I mean literally anything. So I thought that would be, you know, if your mind wanted to think of those things, okay, go on and think about it, get it out of the way, and let's get back to meditation on the breath. So, that was the deal. I bowed, made the aditana and the determination, this is what I would do. And it looked like it wasn't working at all. The mind was still as hard to keep on the breath. It wasn't going to submit to my breath. Still, these thoughts would come up, you'd grab hold of them, pull them back. As soon as you pulled them back, you'd watch the breath, and it'd be off again. And it's the weirdest, strangest things. And it was just such a battle all day. But it came to 3 p.m. So I went up to my hut. Because I'd been sitting so long, I leaned against the wall. I put my feet out and said, right mind, now you can think whatever you want. Anything goes. Sex, romance, anything. And for the next 1 hour, my mind just watched the breath so peacefully. It was easy. And I learned a lesson from that. I learned that the reason why my mind was all over the place was because I was trying to control it. I realized I was feeding it the energy which sent it out, thinking about this, fantasizing about that. But as soon as I said, okay, you can think whatever you want, and I really did let go, then the mind was still. And just like the most obedient of children, it just stayed with the breath without any effort at all. It was so peaceful. It taught me a great lesson. the difference between letting go, and controlling. If you can really understand that, meditation is easy. People try that and they think, I'm letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. But they're not letting go. They're still controlling. What they're doing is they're saying, let go. Come on, you're going to let go. Let go, let go, let go, let go. That is just another type of controlling. It's doing things. Real letting go is very difficult. Because you have to go out of the way. You have to disappear. And then letting go happens. Which is why that if you understand anatta, non-self, then you'll be able to let go. So, because it's difficult, we have these stages of letting go. All the stages of meditation which I teach are just what happens when you let go. When you abandon, when the mind becomes peaceful as you let go little by little, as you abandon, as you renounce, these are the natural stages of the mind. In the same way that when you go on a journey, you pass this village and that forest. It's just what happens when you go on a journey. And the thing is to say, do you have to pass that intersection? Do you have to pass that forest? Do you have to pass that village? Of course you do. It's just part of the journey, that's all. And those signposts which are on the journey to deep meditation are these. It's present moment awareness, where time disappears. It's silence, where the mind stops thinking. It's taking up one thing, your meditation object, the first stage of one-pointedness, just on one thing. And that one thing becomes happy as your body starts to disappear. Abandoning the body. Abandoning the five senses as you come to your first encounter with your mind as a brilliant light. And then eventually abandoning the controller, the doer, to get into the jhanas. We go in. And as you be able to feel yourself just going in as you do this. The simile which comes from the Hindu tradition of meditation, it's supposed to be in the Bhagavad Gita, but I read that some years ago and I couldn't find it. It's supposed to be there somewhere. It's of the teacher who had three students and he taught the students to meditate using the art of archery. Some of you heard this simile before, but please listen again because it will reinforce an important aspect of meditation. What I mean by going in. The master taught these three students great feats of marksmanship by telling them to concentrate and be still, teaching them samadhi. And to give them a test, he took a stuffed bird, like a doll, but looking like a bird, and put it on a tree, on a branch, a long way away. And he gave the bow and arrow to his first student, and gave him the task of shooting that bird, not anywhere, but through the left eyeball. Even the right eyeball would not be good enough. To be able to do that was a huge feat of archery. Have you ever seen these Zen practitioners who on horseback, going very, very fast, not even holding on to the reins, could shoot an arrow as they rush past and get it right in the center of a target. It's an incredible feat to see. And this was a similar feat, to shoot a bird through the eyeball such a long way away. And he gave the bow and arrow to the first student and said, that's the task, make yourself one with the target, take as long as you like, but before you release the arrow, give me a sign. I want to ask you a question. So the first student focused on the left eyeball of the bird. And when he thought he was concentrated enough to shoot, he gave the master a sign. And the master said, can you see the bird on the tree? Yes, master. Stupid student, said the master, and pulled the bow and arrow away. Go and learn some more meditation. He didn't know what he'd done wrong. But the bow and arrow was given to the second student. Same instructions. Make yourself one with the target. I want you to shoot the arrow through the left eyeball. But before you shoot, give me a sign. And this student, he meditated and concentrated for 1 whole hour. And then he gave the master a sign. And the master asked the same question. Student, can you see the bird on the tree? What tree? Said the student. The master smiled. He was interested. Can you see the bird on the tree? You can't see the tree. Can you see the bird? Oh, yes, master. Stupid student. And he pushed the student away, grabbed the bow and arrow, told him to go off and meditate some more, and he gave it to the third student. Same instructions. One with the target. Concentrate as long as you like. Before you shoot, give me a sign. And this student just stood there for 2 long hours, focusing and concentrating. And when he was ready to shoot, he gave the teacher a sign. Can you see the bird on the tree? Said the master. What tree? Said the student. The master smiled. Can you see the bird? What bird? Said the student. The master smiled even more. Well, what can you see? All I can see, master, is 1 eyeball. Ah, said the master, fire. And he released the arrow. And because that was the only thing he could see, that was the only place the arrow could go. It was a dead hit. It wasn't a bullseye, it was a bird's eye. God, that's a joke. And so you've got a bird's eye, not a bull's eye. So, the moral of that story is to show what happens when we focus with stillness on an object. You focus, if you're looking at me, after a while you won't see Mangala sitting next to me. You won't even see the Buddha behind me. You won't even see the microphone to my right. As you focus, all that's on the outside starts to disappear. And all that's left is what is in the center. The nature of the mind is to focus. And if you don't believe me, look at the more modern simile of the television. And if you understand this simile, you can save many thousands of ringgit. When you watch a TV, when you first switch it on, what do you see? You'll be able to see the photo of your maybe grandmother on top of the television. You'll be able to see the magazines underneath, the flowers to the side, or whatever else you've got on the outside of that television. When you first switch it on. But as you focus because of interest in what's going on in the screen, you'll find that all that's on the periphery will soon disappear from your conscious awareness. In fact, after a few seconds, even the edges of the screen will disappear. You will not be conscious of whether it's a wood-paneled television on the outside, a metal or whatever it is. Even if you had a diamond-shaped screen, or a circular screen, it wouldn't matter. After a while, you wouldn't see that. I've sat on these aircraft and they've got these tiny screens. It doesn't matter if you've got a tiny screen or a big, 3 foot, 6 foot plasma screen. After a while, it all looks the same. Small screen TV or a huge screen TV. Once you focus in, the mental experience is identical. Check it out and see. Next time you go on an aircraft and there's one of these little screens in front and there's a movie on, check it out, look at it. Such a small screen. But after a while, the mind focuses in and it fills the whole mind in much the same way as a huge movie screen in one of these multiplex complexes. So, it's a waste of money buying these huge plasma screen TVs. Because it actually looks exactly the same when you're watching. You can actually buy a tiny screen. And your experience is exactly the same, and you can save more money to give to Chempaka Buddhist Lodge. But the point is that this is what happens when we focus. We go into the center. When you start focusing, you start first of all going into the center of what? Into the center of time. Into the now. Sometimes that people work to get into the present moment, but you know, it's going to happen naturally. Just working, just they're trying to bring your mind back from the part, from the future, bring it back from the past, putting it in the present moment. It will happen naturally after a while. But nevertheless, focus into the center of time, into the now. That's the only place where things are happening. All the rest is either fantasy or uncertain ideas of what happened in the past. Anybody who has spoken to, say, traffic cops would know that even two people, even you, if you saw a traffic accident and they asked you things like, what was the colour of the car? Half the time you'd get it wrong. Even what lane it was in and what happened. Two people or three people give three different accounts of what happened, even though you saw it. Even the memory of a short time ago is very uncertain. Where did you put your shoes before you came in here? Even what you ate for breakfast, are you really sure that was what you ate? We think we're sure, but sometimes we're wrong. And that's only this morning. What about last week? Earlier on? Look, the past is just so uncertain. We get it wrong again and again and again. That's why we have arguments about who said what or who did what. The future is also incredibly uncertain. There's one of those stories in my book about fortune tellers. Some people, especially people in Malaysia, like to go to fortune tellers. And one of my sayings is, never trust a poor fortune teller. It makes sense. If you're getting over a fortune teller, go to a rich one. If they can't tell their own fortune, how can they tell yours? And this story is one day when somebody asked my teacher, Ajahn Chah, to tell his fortune. Now, good monks of our tradition are not allowed to tell fortunes, even though that some monks have got great psychic abilities. It's against our rules. But this man decided to push his luck. He went up to the great teacher, my master Ajahn Chah, who did have great psychic powers, and asked him, please tell my fortune. He said, well, look, we don't do that. He said, now listen, I've given so many donations to this monastery. I fed you for so many years. In the first days when no one knew you, it was me who looked after you more than anyone else. I even abandoned my family and business to drive you around. Surely you owe me some debt of gratitude. The least you can do, because I know you can do this, the least you can do out of gratitude. You teach us to be grateful. Now you be grateful to me. Read my palm. And of course, it was one of those requests a monk finds it very hard to refuse. Because it was true, the man had really sacrificed himself. So Ajahn Chah said, okay, I will make an exception. This was the only time my master read the lines on somebody's palm to tell him his fortune. And it was incredible how accurate Ajahn Chah was and how what he predicted actually came true. It's amazing. He took his palm and Ajahn Chah started, with his finger, started tracing the lines. very slowly. And of course, the man was getting very excited. He knew that whatever Ajahn Chah saw must be correct, because he was a great monk. Ajahn Chah would never lie. And every now and again, he would trace the lines with utter concentration and say, "Wow, look at that. Oh, that's interesting. And this man was getting more and more excited. He couldn't wait to find out what Ajahn Chah had seen. And then when Ajahn Chah was finished, this man couldn't help himself and say, "Yes, what can you see, sir?" And Ajahn Chah said, "Now listen, I never make mistakes." "Yes, I know, but what can you see?" "And whatever I tell you is going to be true." "Yes, yes, yes, get on with it." And Ajahn Chah gave his prediction, which was absolutely right, as it turned out. He said, "Sir, having looked at your palm, having used my powers, your future, sir, is uncertain." And Ajahn Chah was right. It was a perfect... But the point of that story, if he'd have just said, "Look, we can't predict the future, it's uncertain," no one would have believed it. But when he went through that object lesson and made it very funny and gave many of his disciples, like me, a story they can tell their own disciples, it made a very strong and powerful point that you cannot predict the future. So why do we expect something to happen? Why do we want something to happen? Why do we say in our meditation, or you ask the teacher, "What should I do next?" In meditation there is no next. There is no future. Only now. The future is uncertain. That's what Ajahn Chah said. Absolutely uncertain. So, throw it away. You can't do anything about it. All your craving and will, trying to get into deep meditation in the future, wanting insight to happen next, trying to get into jhana or whatever, is all trying to control the uncertain future. Now, we let go completely of what's going to happen next. Instead, we attend to what's happening now. Who cares about the future? You can't predict it, completely uncertain. You could be enlightened in the next moment, but the chances are you'd be just as stupid. But whatever you do about it, in fact, if you do anything about it, it makes it worse. So stop predicting the future. Or just stop. What do we mean by stop? It means we're not going anywhere. Very often, you're going somewhere. You're supposed to be on this retreat, but many of you are going somewhere. You're going off into the future, you're going off into the past, you're going off into expectations, you're going off into fantasies, going anywhere except stopping where you are. No expectations, present moment awareness is all about stopping. Who was one of the most unlikely of people to become enlightened in the time of the Buddha? Angulimala. A serial killer who was running after the Buddha. And how did Angulimala become enlightened? The Buddha said, "Stop." What do you mean, stop? Stop. Angulimala stopped. He wasn't just running after the Buddha, the physical Buddha. He was running after enlightenment. Are you running after the Buddha? Do you know what I mean? Meditating, I'm running after enlightenment, running after jhana, running after bliss, running after... If you're running after the Buddha, it's called craving, desire. In your meditation, you'll find, yeah, you're running. You're running somewhere. You're running after the Buddha. And the Buddha sometimes turns around and says, "Stop. If you stop running, you're in the present moment. If you stop running, you're in the present moment. You're here at last. So, there was this wonderful story about a novice in our monastery in Thailand many years ago in the time of Ajahn Chah. It's a beautiful story which shows you how easy it is to get into deep meditation, almost enlightened. This little novice was sitting down like you are on the hard concrete, on a marble. Wouldn't it be nice if they built these meditation halls with about, just on the floor, instead of marble, about 6 inches of foam. So you can sit down really nice. It's always hard. Now this is okay here in this temple. That floor is flat. In the monasteries in Thailand, it was the villagers who laid the concrete. And they could not keep that concrete flat. It was bumpy. So as a young monks, you had to sit on the bumpy concrete. And after a while it got not just hard, but sore. We didn't have any cushions. I started to complain. Said, look, it's the senior monks have got all the cushions. And they don't need the cushions. They're so fat, they've got natural upholstery. And we young monks are so thin and bony. But anyhow, there was one talk, one late at night, and when Ajahn Chah started giving a talk, there was no time limit, he just went on and on and on. Sometimes he'd start at 9 o'clock and he wouldn't finish till 4 o'clock in the morning. So he couldn't sleep. And it was one of those evenings. Ajahn Chah was talking. Now, many of you may have read some of Ajahn Chah's books. One thing I will tell you is that when you read his books, that has been filtered. That's the cream of all those wise things he said. When I was there, you had to wait for hours to get one of those beautiful pearls of wisdom. And the rest of it was, quite frankly, rubbish. Talking about this, talking about that, other things. But it was worth it, because every now and again you've got this beautiful, deep wisdom. And of course, now when we have these books by Ajahn Chah, they filter it all out, they just take the cream. But that's not what Ajahn Chah was like. Sometimes it was so boring. And I was interested. I was a monk. I was a Buddhist. But imagine some of these small little novices, now 8, 9 years of age, 12 years maybe, and they were getting so tired and so bored, and they had to sit up, oh, why am I having to do this? Why won't Ajahn Chah stop? And this one little novice, that's what he kept on thinking. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And he kept thinking like this, again and again and again. Then he had what we call an insight. Real insights, you know them by their effect. Something breaks and you go into deep states of stillness and peace. That's the sign of an insight. He was sitting there, when's he going to stop? I'm tired, I'm sore. When? And the insight was, not when Ajahn Chah is going to stop, when am I going to stop? Thought the novice. He told us this afterwards. That's what he thought. He changed his thought from when is Ajahn Chah going to stop to when am I going to stop? And he stopped. A few hours later, he opened his eyes. Everyone was gone. It was early in the morning. He'd been sitting there for I don't know how many hours. So still, so mindful, so happy. He blissed out. He had stopped. That's called letting go. Stopping. So where do you stop? You stop in the present moment. You're not going anywhere. You're not chasing the Buddha. Number two, you're not thinking. That's the second stage of letting go. All this commentary inside of you. Now, always describing everything you experience, giving it a name. My goodness, people even give their cars a name. Sometimes you get these yachts, people give it names. We give everything a name. This is a car, it's not a person. Even you, even this, Ajahn Brahm, it's not a person, it's just a bunch of five khandhas, that's all. We tend to give everything a name. It's called thinking. Now, when we stop, the next stage after present moment awareness is silence. Shh. Nothing moves. The mind stops explaining things. You should be like a scientist. Gather the data rather than writing down your conclusions before the experiment is finished. You see already that people are writing things down. Why do you write things down? Don't say anything. Don't make a commentary. Allow it to be still. Listen, the last retreat I gave was last month in Perth. One of the meditators there, she was from Melbourne. She was a Sri Lankan girl. She told me she'd been meditating since she was a child, back in Sri Lanka somewhere. She managed to find a very good teacher, someone I never knew about. Because this teacher told her how to get still. And she used that stillness when she was going to university in Melbourne. She said she didn't go to any tutorials, just went to the lectures. She didn't need to go to the tutorials. She got top marks every year in her university, the top. She said that when the lecturer was speaking, she just made her mind very still, present moment awareness and silence. She didn't think. She soaked it all in. If you're thinking, you're not listening. Because if you're thinking, you're listening to your thoughts, not what the lecturer is saying. There's a great difference there. If you're thinking, you're not listening to Dhamma, the experience of life. You're listening to what you think about life. You're listening to delusion. If you're thinking, you can't see Dhamma. Dhamma can only be seen, experienced in the silence. So she was so silent, she could listen to her lecturer. She soaked it all in. When it came to the examination time, or time to do an assignment, she said the first thing which came into her mind, her teacher said, write that down straight away. She said it was always right. She didn't need to push her mind. Oh, what's the answer? Think, think, think. That always got the wrong answer. That's why she was successful at university, brilliant, they thought, just because she knew how to listen and she knew how to perform from silence. Now, do you understand why we can teach the Dhamma but no one understands? Because very few people know how to listen. Make the mind still, silent. And everything you listen to, you'll be able to recall. Last week, before I came here, we had a visiting Thai monk. A great monk, Ajahn Pliyan, from the north of Thailand. He's very, very well known, very famous, great powers. He came to visit my monastery for 1 week. When we had a question and answer session or a talk, I had to do the translating from Thai into English. And sometimes, when you do a translated talk, these monks can't help themselves. They start talking for about 10 or 15 minutes and they turn to say, translate it. If you have one sentence, it's easy. But 10 or 15 minutes, you've got this huge amount of information you've got to store in your brain and then recall it. Even though you know how busy I am, talking to people all day and in the evening I had to do the translating. The other monks with me were very impressed, because when he finished 10 or 15 minutes translate, I translated it into English, all in line what he had said. So how do you do that, Ajahn Brahm? So it's easy. When he was speaking, I listened. I never tried to remember. If you try to remember, you'll mess it up. Absolutely still, very, very soft. Not trying, not being afraid, not trying to remember, not taking notes in your mind. Be very peaceful. When it all goes in, then it's like you press a rewind button. Then you start from the very beginning. You don't think about what's going to come next. It just flows naturally. It's great when that happens. You know how to listen, how to remember, how to recall. Silence is golden, not just because it's happy, it gives you a lot of power. So, in this meditation, that's the next level to get rid of. Thinking, naming, giving all words. As you let go, you get into silence. The mind is not moving anymore. First of all, time stops, and then the mind stops, no thinking. The next level is you let go of diversity. At least getting into present moment awareness and silence is actually very, very profound. But usually we now, at this stage, take up a meditation object. The breath, the body, whatever it is, loving kindness, the point is you take up one concept rather than many. So the mind is not thinking of many, is not aware of many things, it just takes one thing. When it just takes one thing, because you're in the present moment, because you're silent, there's very little to disturb the object of your meditation. What happens is you start focusing even more in. You take up one thing, and then you go to that one thing within that one thing. You're starting this whole process of going deeper in to your body and mind. The breath, as it were, is in the center of the body. It's that central to your life. When you start watching the breath, you might start watching in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. Now listen, it does not matter where you watch the breath. Tip of the nose, belly, who cares? This is from my own experience. I started meditation. I was taught, watch the tip of your nose. I suffer from hay fever. So sometimes my nose was so blocked up, I said, I can't see any breath. I keep on watching. Why I couldn't see it? Because it wasn't there. There was no breath coming in and out. No wonder I couldn't see it. So next of all, I said, watch the belly. So I could watch the belly at first, but when I became a monk, that was not the right place to watch. If you watch the belly late in the afternoon on this retreat, it's so close to the stomach, you start to feel hungry. And sometimes the breath wasn't there either. And I realized afterwards, the Buddha actually said, to watch the breath, not the belly, not the nose, watch the breath. Imagine that you were employed by the police. And the police told you that Ajahn Brahm, he's come from Australia, we don't know about these Australians these days, maybe he's a terrorist, look, he's got robes on, who knows what, he's getting fat, is that really fat or is that sort of a suicide belt under there? So they say, watch this guy. So you're supposed to watch Ajahn Brahm. How do you watch Ajahn Brahm? You just watch him in the monastery, sometimes not in the monastery in Serpentine, sometimes I'm here in Chimpaka Lodge. So if they're watching me at the monastery, they'll never find me. Why? Because I'm here. If they watch me here next week when I'm in Penang, they'll never see me. If you're going to follow a suspect, if you're going to watch them, you've got wherever that suspect goes, that's where you go. They go in the toilet, you go in the toilet. They go in the bank, you go in the bank. If they go into the bedroom, you have to go to the bedroom. Wherever the person or the thing goes, you have to go along. So that's the same with the breath. If you're watching the breath, wherever the breath is, that's where you watch. It's obvious when I explain it that way. But first I thought you've got to watch it at one place. Well, the breath is supposed to be here. Well, the breath is supposed to be there. I looked there and I couldn't find it. Why? Because it wasn't there, it was somewhere else. People lose sense, touch, lose awareness of the breath for that reason. They're watching at the wrong place. So I developed this little technique. I asked myself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? If I could ask that question, I knew I wasn't dead, so I had to be breathing in or breathing out. It had to be one of the two. There's no other option. If I was dead, I would not be able to ask that question. So it was going in or it was going out, one of the two, how do I know? And I could always tell whether the breath was going in, I could always tell whether the breath was going out. And it was that sensation, that feeling, that experience. That's what I watched. It did not matter where that experience was located in the body. It did not matter how that experience manifested, whether it was pleasant or unpleasant, long or short, rough or smooth. That was not the point. As long as I knew the breath. And actually it became very helpful not to locate the breath anywhere on the body. It was as if I was disembodying the breath. Watching the breath but not the body. That helped get deep into meditation. Because once you've got the breath, you're supposed to let go of the body. People when they're meditating will notice, when you're meditating, your hands disappear, your legs disappear, your back disappears, your head disappears. Just like the bird on the tree. The tree disappears for the archer. Then the bird disappears and you're left with an eyeball. Or when you're watching the TV, the picture of your mother on top, the magazines underneath, the flowers to the side, they disappear. They're supposed to disappear. Then the wooden screen, the wooden boundary of the screen disappears. You just see the center of the screen. It's supposed to happen. The body is supposed to disappear. Fall off your screen as you focus just on the feeling of the breath. This is what we mean by the way of one-pointedness. Having oneness. As you go deeper and deeper and deeper, the breath starts to become fully occupying your mind. First of all, you might just know in, out, in, out, in, out. After a while, you know the whole breath from the very beginning to the end. Of each in-breath, of each out-breath. It's as if the breath fills every corner of your attention. You're fully aware of the breath. And something happens next, which I'll talk about probably this evening, of how, because the mind is being filled with one thing, because you're not doing anything, because there's no past, there's no thoughts, the mind starts to experience happiness. The mind becomes bright, becomes more mindful than you've ever been before. There are many levels of mindfulness, ordinary mindfulness, powerful mindfulness, and what I call superpower mindfulness. I'll explain that later, but you start to experience superpower mindfulness now. Seeing the breath, you can really see it fully. Amazing what you can see. It's always been there, but you're not mindful enough to see the whole thing. And it grows naturally. And with that mindfulness, with that power, comes great energy and joy and happiness. It's why I call this stage the beautiful breath. You're sitting there, focusing in on the breath. Oh my goodness, it's amazing, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous. You're just so happy, sitting here watching this delightful, delicious breath. It's just like you've got this amazing meal in front of you. Oh, every taste, every mouthful is absolutely more delicious than you've ever had before. Mmm, this is nice. Now this is where the meditation really starts to get fun. This is when people start to get these stages, oh, I start to get happy. You're starting to know what meditation is. Once you start getting to these happy states, then you're on the edge of great things. Not only is the mind powerful, it's happy. And because it's happy, it just loves investigating. Investing, going in. Now, invest is actually clothing yourself. Getting in to those clothes. Getting inside. This is what happens when we go in. We go into that beauty. The whole body you'll find has disappeared. Time has disappeared. You haven't got a clue what people are doing around you. You don't care. It's just so wonderful. You go into that beauty. At that time, these wonderful, amazing lights appear in the mind. When those happen, you're very mindful, very blissed out. and you don't know what's going on around. And this is getting deep. When these things, and this is getting deep. When these things happen, please don't get scared. They're supposed to happen. They are great. If you do get scared, remember, you are in good company. The Buddha got scared. That's why he said, "Why should I be afraid of this bliss which has nothing to do with the world? I will not be afraid of that bliss." Actually, the Buddha to be, just before he became enlightened, said in the Mahasatika Sutta, number 36 of the Majjhima Nikaya, "You will find fear." You know what that fear is? That fear is challenging your deep attachments. All fear is a fear of losing things we think we own. You're challenging the deeper attachments. I'm going to give a talk about this. This is that little area where the powerful insights are found in the deep stages of meditation. Those are the insights into the deep attachments which tie you to rebirth. As we let go more and more, no fear, incredible bliss, stillness, you're one-pointed, you go deeper and deeper inside. You're in to time, present moment, into that silence. You're right in the middle of the body. The body has just disappeared, just like the television screen. You're into the mind. That's called jhanas. When you go into that nimitta, you start even going further in. The things start to disappear. Things which you thought you were are no longer there. You see anatta. Suffering is disappearing. You're seeing the end of suffering. Experiencing it temporarily, but at least getting a taste of freedom. That's what the Buddha called the Dhamma. Just like the ocean has one and the same taste, salt, so this Dhamma has one and the same taste, the taste of freedom. And you're experiencing these things. But when these things happen, you are in the presence of Nibbana. And what happens next? I will tell you later on. Thank you. Okay. That's the basic method of meditation. Sum it up again. Present moment awareness. Silence. Taking meditation object, the breath. Full awareness of the breath. Breath becomes beautiful. Get nimittas coming up. When nimittas come up, the breath is disappeared. Breath has done its job. Leave it alone. Then you get into deep meditation. You get into deep meditation. Insights, they just flow. Any questions? Anyone has a question now? It's a good time after the talk to open it up for questions. We've got 10 or 15 minutes of question time. Remember that story I've told every time I come to KL about karma in the, was it the Karma Vibhanga Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya? The Buddha said what you have to do in this life to get reborn wealthy in your next life. Why is it some people are born poor? What they've done in the last life to become poor in this life? What you have to do to become healthy in the next life? Why some people are born sickly? In particular, the Buddha said why some people are born stupid in their next life, while other people are born intelligent in their next life. And the Buddha said the karmic reason for intelligence in your next life is asking questions in this one. So many questions. Not just in the next life, just today. So if you've got a question there about what to do, please ask. No? Oh yeah? Say something about the nimitta. I'll actually talk in detail about the nimitta later on during this retreat. But what it actually is, I'll give you a taste. It is actually a reflection of your mind. This is the first time you see what this word citta really is. because you're experiencing the citta. It's the mind, the citta sees itself. It's very difficult to explain, but this is a pure mental object, which is very rare. We hardly ever see a pure mental object. All there are experiences, we think we know the mind, but it's really just sight, sound, smells, taste or touches. All their echoes in the mind. Even our thoughts are of sight, sound, smells, taste, touches. It's not really pure mind. But when all of those five senses disappear, which is, in first jhana, it's called viviche kamehi, being separated from the five senses. When those senses disappear, that's all you're left with, just mind. And that appears to people as the most beautiful light. It is not seen by the eye. The mind is experiencing this. But that's the only way you can perceive it. Perception, sanya, is very conditioned by memory. That's why in Thai, the word for memory is sometimes sanya, what in the Buddha called perception. Because whatever we describe it as, we use the categories of our previous experience. When I look at you, man, why do I say that perception? Because of all the other men I've seen, and you're similar. Sometimes these days you get it wrong though, because I don't know if it's a man or woman or what it is. But I assume. So perception actually gives it a name. And because the language of our perception is the world of the five senses, that pure mental experience is commonly interpreted as a light. But there's certain aspects of that experience which you will notice. It's a light, it's a color, but it is unearthly in the sense that you've never seen a color quite like that before. If it's a yellow, it's not like the yellow of those flowers in front of me. It's the most amazing, deep and rich yellow. And it's also a sense of power and beauty and energy. It's intense and rich. It's a sign, it's a nimitta. There are many different types of nimittas. Some of them are just going all over the place. They're not stable. Some of them are just complicated. They may be visions of fields or palaces. That's not good enough. That shows the mind is not ready yet. It's too complicated. It's unstable. So this is why we have to work at the preliminary stages. So when a nimitta comes up, it is very simple. Just like a moon released from the clouds. Very brilliant. Shows we've got a lot of energy. And still. Which means we've done our job in letting go and allowing things to stop. When the nimittas come up to that stage, then you're right next to jhanas. Is that the question you asked? Be more about nimittas coming up soon. Yeah. Okay. I'm talking about the doer and the knower. This is one of the ways I describe meditation. The doer and the knower. To explain what those things are. The cause of you asking that question, what motivates you to think, the manager, the doer, the will, the chooser, the fault finder, that which is active of your mind, I call the doer. The passive part of the mind is the knower, just what receives the information. You just know in most machines, You've got what receives the information, the input side, and you've got the output side, what reacts to the information you receive. Of the mind, you've got the knower, which is consciousness, awareness. You've got the output, which is the doer, choice, will. What moves you is the doer. In meditation, what we're attempting to achieve is to calm down the doer, but keep the knower very alert. Sometimes, because doing and knowing are so close together, when some people meditate, when they calm the doer down, don't do anything, let go. They also let go of the knower as well. They fall asleep. That's because I let go of the knower and the doer. Now the thing is, you have to separate those two out in meditation. Let go of the doer. Allow it to stop. If you try and stop the doer, that's doing again. That's doing letting go. It's not letting go of doing. There's a lot of difference between doing letting go and letting go of doing. Hopefully you understand that. If you try and stop the doer, it won't work. So you don't stop, you don't do anything. No doing. It stops by itself. You can't hold it. You got to put it down. And it stops. Does that answer the question? See what happens when you get peaceful? Why? Did you make that peace? Or did you get out of the way and allow peace to come? The point is, it's you who disturb the mind. If you would only get out of the way, realize anatta, stop doing things, get to a state of emptiness, the whole world stops by itself. That is nature. We interfere. Any other questions? Going, going, gone. So I'm going to stop now, but I'm going to go somewhere. Please excuse me today, because in the Malaysian Buddhist Cooperative, I think, that about a year ago, I think the last retreat, they asked me to support a project for trying to give some advice, some Buddhist advice about funerals, so that people understand exactly what to do at a funeral, and they don't waste so much money, they can overcome some of the superstition. They're launching their little booklet today. I've got it in my bag here, which is called Bidding Farewell to Life and Beneficial Last Rites. And so because I work rather forward to this, they're going to have a launch of this morning. So please excuse me as I go to this little Buddhist ceremony. I'll be back at 2 o'clock. So this morning there won't be any interviews. And normally I don't like interviews on the first day, because you've got nothing to report. You just started. So the interviews will start this afternoon. I think the time for the interviews is, what time is it? It's 3:30. Yeah, 3:30 the interviews will start. So again, I'll try and get back by 2 o'clock, but if I'm a bit late, please keep the schedule. Remember that if this monk and that novice is gone, you've always got one monk looking after you. The monk who sits so still behind me. See if you can sit as still as the Buddha behind me, and then you'll have great meditation. Okay, so I'll see you this afternoon. Have a nice lunch. Please keep the rules. No talking. No whispering. That's still talking. Have a nice lunch. Have a rest afterwards if you need a rest. Take it easy. And just allow this whole process to develop. It's not up to you. You think you're good, you're bad. I've got to really try hard. I don't have to try hard. Sometimes it's like the simile of an aircraft. Sometimes when I go to overseas, I'll get on the aeroplane from Perth. It's like some people, they rush to the front of the plane, thinking they're going to get to Malaysia quicker. Some people, they laze at the back of the plane, And people say, "Ah, you lazy, you're not going to get there anyway." Once you're on the Eightfold Path, once you're on Buddha air, you think you're making the effort or you're not making the effort. It's not up to you. It's the path makes the effort, not you. It just happens. Energy comes. Striving comes, but it's not you doing the striving. You're on the aircraft. Buddha Air flies a plane, not you. Okay, have a nice day.